Spangola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spangola. I'm coming to you from the steamy suburbs of Chicago. I really appreciate you joining me today on RBN. Their website is republicbroadcasting.org. Please also visit spangola.com for a list of future guests and relevant links. Please also visit spangolaspeaks.wordpress.com, a site that one of our listeners created. During the program, email your questions or comments to comment@spangola.com. Join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website or by visiting spangola.chatango.com. We will be taking calls in the second hour at 800-313-9443. My guest the first 2 hours is Dr. Jeannie Stolzer. The name is spelled S-T-O-L-Z-E-R. She is a professor of child and adolescent development at the University of Nebraska at Kearney. She currently teaches infant, child, and adolescent classes and is an active researcher. Dr. Stolzer has published numerous peer-reviewed articles and has presented her research at the international level and has been published on 5 continents. I read some of her papers this morning, and in fact I have linked a couple of those papers on the schedule page. And when you download the first one, it's called The Systemic Correlation Between Psychiatric Medications and Unprovoked Mass Murder in America, you'll see the first paragraph. It is a PDF file, and please be sure and follow through and download that to your computer. Save it and read it. It is absolutely wonderful. Another one of her papers that I read this morning, The Risks Associated with Maternal Antidepressant Use During the Prenatal and Postnatal Stages of Development. She wrote the following: ADHD-type behaviors are nothing new. They have been documented across cultures, across time, and across mammalian species. The fact of the matter is that children have always been fidgety, highly active, inattentive, spontaneous, and prone to engage in behaviors that exacerbate adults. What has been compendiously altered is our collective perception of what constitutes normal range child behaviors. And she's going to explain a lot of this. Thank you so much for being on the program today, Dr. Stolzer.
Thank you so much for having me. It's good to be here.
Oh, we talked about an hour and a half ago, and I just could hardly wait until you were on the program, because you had so many things to say. And people really do need to hear this. And we have been bamboozled about psychiatric drugs, and they are incredibly, incredibly dangerous. So tell us about how they got voted in and why they are so popular.
Well, I think what's important to note, you know, just to start this conversation, is since the beginning of recorded human history, feelings such as sadness, worry, anxiety, or behaviors such as running, jumping, climbing, fidgeting, not paying attention, these were considered to be integral components of the human experience until we get to about 1989, 1990. Then they've been collectively defined in the United States as psychiatric illnesses, i.e. disorders of the brain, if you will, that require dangerous and addictive drugs. And I don't think that most people understand that these diseases are actually voted in by the American Psychiatric Association members. Authentic diseases are not voted in. They're discovered through scientific methodology. These diseases, such as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, anxiety disorder, these are voted in, and the criteria changes a lot. For example, with ADHD, it used to say that these behaviors must be displayed across contexts. Now it says, must be displayed in at least 2 contexts. So the criterion changes, they're voted in and out of existence. Most people don't know that homosexuality was voted in as a verifiable psychiatric disorder, and then was consequently voted out in 1978. And in my opinion, this is lunacy. Diseases that can be voted in and out of existence. But homosexuality was voted out because no one was making any money. We weren't mass drugging homosexuals with psychiatric medications. Schools weren't receiving huge paychecks for each homosexual student they had. So that one was easy to vote out.
That is just incredible. Now, you mentioned that the school districts receive a certain amount of money from the federal government, depending on how many students they have that are on medication. And, in fact, they promote the use of medication.
Absolutely, they do. As a matter of fact, about 98% of all referrals for psychiatric diagnoses in children and adolescents come directly from the United States public school system. And that is startling.
That is amazing, 98%. So a teacher, all a teacher has to do is say, oh, that kid is really problematic, and then they could just recommend to the parents that they get the child on Ritalin or some other drug.
Yes.
And so go ahead and talk to us about that.
Federal law prohibits teachers from demanding that students are on particular psychiatric drugs. And it also makes it clear that teachers are not to mention anything like ADHD or depression. They can absolutely mention behaviors, like he's off task or, you know, he's not paying attention. Those are code words for ADHD. But not very many parents or teachers, for that matter, are aware that we do have federal laws protecting our students, recommending particular diagnoses and sending children to different doctors is rampant in our school system. And when you look at the economic linkages, it should come as no surprise. I mean, schools are making money for each child that's formally diagnosed, and many parents don't know this.
Holy cow. That is amazing. And this money comes from the federal government, which, of course, is the taxpayers, because the federal government does not actually produce anything.
That's right. It's our money.
Right. Wow. Oh, my gosh.
1990-91 is when the amendment to the Disabilities Act was included to include non-physical disabilities. See, prior to that amendment, it's called IDEA, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. Prior to that, schools only received money for physically disabled students, the blind, the deaf, the paraplegic, which makes perfect sense because it costs more money to educate them. We need Braille, we need interpreters, you know, we need ramps and things like that. It makes sense that
sure.
There's monies for physically disabled students. What doesn't make any sense is that a child with ADHD requires money from the school because it's the parents that's responsible for the methylphenidate, the drugs that we're giving them, not the school.
Amazing. And there's the percentage of children that are on drugs in any given school district is about 10% in some areas, right?
It's about 10% in some areas, but in other areas it's as high as 45%.
Oh, where would that be?
I believe it's parts of Connecticut.
Oh, really?
What's very, very interesting is the prevalence rate of psychiatric illness with our children in American schools. Private schools typically have very, very low rates because they're not getting any federal money. There's no financial incentive. So it looks very much like my fourth grade class in 1968. You know, why would you diagnose a child? You get money for it.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, we do have to go to a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest this first 2 hours is Dr. Jeannie Stolzer. And do be sure to visit the schedule page and download those PDF files and also read the other article that I have linked there. Dr. Stolzer has written a lot about what is going on in the school system and a lot about psych drugs. And Doctor, you were talking about the children in private schools versus the children in government schools, and there's quite a difference.
Yeah, the disparity is really startling when you see 0 to 1% psychiatric illnesses in private schools, and you compare that with the 10, 20, 30, 40, 45% that we see in public schools. And you can trace that directly to the economic incentive to label children. Like I said before, private schools are not receiving a dime. So they're not, you know, there's no incentive to do that.
Ah, sure. And of course, you also have to look at the kids that go to a private school versus those that go to a public school. And perhaps, I don't know, maybe the parents who send their children to a private school know something that the rest of us don't know.
Maybe they do, but if you look at American education, you know, in generalities, there was no psychiatric illnesses in child populations in schools. I mean, your listeners probably understand, you know, if they're 40 or over, that when they were in school, not one classmate was on ADHD drugs. Not one classmate was on antidepressants. Now, that's not to say there were no classmates who weren't running, jumping, climbing, fidgeting. Of course they were. I was one of those kids. I was on the go all the time. I wasn't recommended to see a psychiatrist. I was doing all types of chores around the school all the time because I was in trouble for not paying attention. So I think when we look back to our own collective experience in school, we can see this monumental paradigm shift that has occurred, and people have to be asking, what happened in the course of less than one generation that we have millions and millions and millions of children and infants on psychiatric meds? What happened? We used to deal with these problems with living in a very, very different way, typically behavioral modification.
Right. Talking to your children, actually engaging in good parenting. And nobody would have thought, of course, that was before they categorized these behaviors as a disease. And they did that in order to access insurance payments, in order to access, well, in order to make money.
You're bringing up a really good point with insurance companies. I have really good insurance, and my insurance will pay for 3 sessions of talk therapy, 3 sessions.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Then I'm required to pay the rest. But for psychiatric drugs, they'll pay 100% for my lifetime.
Oh, my gosh.
An important component here. We've got to get on the insurance companies. Why are you supporting the pharmaceutical industry? Why will you not support talk therapy? Because many of us throughout our lives need tools to deal with problems of living. You know, we need ways to handle anxiety or depression or overactivity or not being able to pay attention. But right now, the only treatment for that that's available for insurance companies is psych drugs.
And of course, the psychiatrist can see a lot more patients because they only spend 10 to 15 minutes with patients who come in and just have their med check sessions. And then they go off on their way and they get billed. I get probably the same amount of money as if the doctor had spent an hour listening and having compassion and understanding and helping the patient to see a different perception of what's going on, right?
Right. And you bring up 2 really important points. One is psychiatrists used to be talk therapists. They did. Mm-hmm. I mean, Freud started all this with psychoanalysis.
Mm-hmm.
And he would talk and talk until you got to the root of your problem, which is actually a cure, instead of applying Band-Aid solutions such as psychiatric drugs, which cure nothing. The second point you made is that we're assuming that all of these diagnoses are made by psychiatrists. And I think the last time I looked, 2013 data, was that about 63% of all psychiatric diagnoses were coming from general practitioners. These are GP physicians. They're not psychiatrists.
Exactly. And they spend about the same amount of time, 10 minutes with the patient. And go ahead.
Of course, there's no blood urinalysis. There's no blood work. There's no urinalysis. There's no MRI. There's no CAT scan. There's no PET scan. There's a list of questions. And if you have 6 out of the 9, you have the disease. most people, when they think about that, I mean, really, in a scientific way, know that that's lunacy. You don't diagnose a medical condition with a questionnaire.
Exactly.
I think it's important, too, we talk about numbers. The New York Times, did you happen to see that? Just published some numbers with infants and children and with regards to psychiatric drugs.
I did not see that.
Are you ready for this?
Yeah, hit us with it.
Okay, this is infants from birth to 1 year. These are babies who can't walk. Birth to 1 year. About 250,000 babies are on anti-anxiety drugs. This is only American data. Over 26,000 babies are on antidepressant drugs. About 1,500 babies are on ADHD medications. And about 654 American babies are on antipsychotic drugs. Babies. Now when we get to 2 to 3 year olds, the toddler group, about 319,000 are on anti-anxieties. About 46,000, no, I think it's over 46,000, are on antidepressants. Almost 4,000 are on antipsychotics. 10,000 are on ADHD drugs. So the total numbers from birth to five on psychiatric drugs in America is over 1 million children. 6 to 12 year olds on psychiatric drugs, we have over 4 million. 13 to 17 year olds, over 3 million. I think it's really important for your listeners to go to cchrint.org. There's a Parents Know Your Rights page there, and it's very, very important that parents do know their rights and that they understand what's happening with the psychiatric drugging of our infants and children.
Oh, my gosh. And I do have that linked on the schedule page, but the numbers are criminal. To do this to a nation's children, infants with antipsychotic drugs, ADHD, what in heaven's name are these parents thinking? And what are these physicians thinking? Are they getting some kind of a kickback? I just do not understand why somebody with common sense would do this. It's very disturbing to me. I'm just outraged by it.
It's criminal. My estimation, it is criminal. And what we're doing as a nation is we're refusing to look at why are our little ones depressed? Why are they anxious? And we're applying Band-Aid solutions in the form of psychiatric drugs. We won't look at our statistics that 77% of our infants are in full-time on parental care.
Oh, let's talk about that when we come back from the break. We will be back in 3 minutes after a word from our sponsors. Back, this is Deanna. Our guest today for the first 2 hours is Dr. Jeannie Stolzer. And we will be taking questions from our listening audience in the second hour at 800-313-9443. And doctor, you said that 77% of our infants are not under parental care, and that could very well contribute to any anxieties that they might feel. Go ahead and talk to us about that.
Well, I want to say clearly that there are many, many converging factors that are related to this skyrocketing diagnosing of our children. But one of those that's really politically incorrect to talk about is attachment disruption in our infants. Never before in the history of the mammalian kingdom, that's all mammals, and humans, by the way, are mammals, never before in the history of the mammalian kingdom have we witnessed the majority of young being cared for by uninvested, unrelated strangers with limited contact to their mothers. And as a direct result of this decreased maternal care, ancient and universal mammalian behavior patterns have been systemically eradicated. We don't know at the present time how fundamental alterations to these behaviors result in psychopathology in our young. What we do know is that these ancient alterations, these alterations to these ancient patterns may very well be related to the high levels of depression and anxiety in our young. And we're just refusing thus far to even look at this because it's so politically explosive to talk about it.
Sure. And I think that a lot of it, too, is it isn't just associated with mothers who are out in the workplace, but just people who say, oh, I need to put my child into a daycare center so that they can develop social skills and learn to play with others. And that just isn't how it was done 50 or 60 years ago.
Well, no, don't even 50 or 60 years ago. Think about 99.999% of our time on this planet. Our babies were never away from their mothers. And if you needed a daycare to learn social processes, that would mean that 99.999% of all humans who've ever lived didn't know any social processes.
Ah.
And that's just lunacy.
It is.
And I think what makes this so politically explosive is, you know, people will say, oh, she's attacking women. She's attacking women. I'm not attacking women. Women have worked for thousands of years and mothered simultaneously. They strapped their babies on their backs and went out in the field.
Mm-hmm. They did.
She isn't a working mother. Mothers have worked for thousands and thousands of years and mothered their young. It's us in modern-day America who said that mothering and working can't occur simultaneously. But baby males need their mothers or a permanent mother substitute. They need a secure base. They need an attachment person that makes them feel safe and strong and secure. And our children are being stripped of that, and we don't want to talk about it.
I totally agree with you. And somebody said something in the chat room, too, that I think is pretty relevant. Let me just scroll back up here. This person said, parents are too lazy today to actually do any parenting. It's much easier to just give the kid a chill pill. Apathy will be our downfall. In fact, it already has been. What do you say to that?
I absolutely believe that. Parenting is tough, and any parent will tell you that. It is the most incredibly trying experience. I mean, every stage of infancy, early childhood, adolescence brings with it its own stresses and storms, and it's tough. So, of course, it's much easier to just drug this child into this, you know, psychiatrically state of, you know, compliance and docility.
Sure. I wonder if that is why the parents of some of these infants are so, well, acquiescent to taking a prescription drug for their children. Maybe the mother is working or something, and she doesn't want to deal with a crying child, a chronic baby. I just can't get over that somebody would give their infant a pill, a psychiatric drug, an antipsychotic drug. I mean, I remember my children were just, I enjoyed their presence. I enjoyed everything they did. I enjoyed their smiles, everything they did. And they were certainly rambunctious. My boys are particularly rambunctious.
Oh, yeah.
My son was very rambunctious, and I just enjoyed every minute of it.
Absolutely. And we don't want to talk about our plummeting breastfeeding rates in this country either, and that can be attributed partly to policy, but that is intrinsically connected to this puzzle piece too, and we don't want to talk about that either.
And but you did write an article about that I also read.
Many, many articles about breastfeeding,
yes,
being attachment parenting. But I have to tell you this story. This happened to me. I was at an international conference last year, and the talk was on ADHD and my research into ADHD, and there was a man from India, a scholar from India in the front row. And when I was giving the actual, I was reading from the DSM, giving the actual symptoms of ADHD, fidgeting, running, jumping, climbing, not paying attention, this Indian scholar stood up in the middle of my talk and said, "Excuse me, could you please repeat those symptoms of this psychiatric disorder?" And so I did. And he said in front of everybody, "In my country, if little boys are not displaying these symptoms, something is wrong with them."
Indeed. So, absolutely.
Indeed, culturally, we have to look at this from a cultural lens, too. Of course little boys are rambunctious, and some little girls, but we have to be honest with this, too, no matter how politically incorrect it is. ADHD is a boy disease. About 94% of all diagnoses occur in young males. So let's just be honest, and we don't care about political correctness. Little boys, by their very nature, are rambunctious, defiant, aggressive, don't pay attention. They run, jump, climb. They exacerbate us in every way. It's not a disease. It's boyhood.
Yes.
And if you can't stand it, then don't have kids. And please don't be a teacher or a preschool teacher or a Head Start teacher, because that's what they do.
Yeah, speaking of Head Start, that all of a sudden, that title itself, that term itself, has taken on a more ominous meaning just from what you've said.
Oh, Head Start, many, many people don't know about Head Start, but it's a federally funded program for low-income children. After about 30, 35 years, we have no data to support that children in Head Start do any better in school than those without Head Start. Well, there is some findings that suggest for kindergarten, first and second grade, there is some benefit, but after that, it all levels out. But what most people don't know, it is federal mandate that each child enrolled in the Head Start program will be assessed for mental health problems, psychiatric illnesses. And as a scientist, this is particularly disturbing to me, because the status of the rater is not controlled for in any way. Who's doing these assessments? Are these psychiatrists? Are these neurologists? And of course the answer is no, these are Head Start workers. And these labels that we're affixing to these 2-, 3-, 4-year-old babies never go away. People don't understand that either. Once a psychiatric label is affixed, it's there for your life.
Wow.
It cannot be taken off.
And of course, when you look at other federally funded programs or federally, well, even just the foster care program, with all of the, well, it's paid for by Medicaid. A lot of the kids in the foster care program receive Medicaid, benefits. And so it's profitable for the pharmaceutical industry to have the majority of those children on psychiatric drugs.
And the majority of foster care children are on psychiatric drugs. This is a travesty. Really, it is. Many of these children have been sexually abused, physically abused, emotionally abused. These children are our most vulnerable. And the best we can do for them is to give them psychiatric drugs instead of caring and compassion and empathy in tools to deal with the horrendous experiences they've had in their little lives.
Oh, goodness. I'm almost in tears just thinking about this. Thank goodness for breaks. We'll be back in 3 minutes after a word from our sponsors. Alrighty, we are back. This is Deanna, and our guest these first 2 hours is Dr. Jeannie Stolzer. And we will take calls in the second hour at 800-313-9443. And Dr. Stolzer mentioned the website where you can learn about parental rights. CCHRINT.org, and the INT stands for International. There's also a petition there regarding the suicidality of all of these veterans, which I hope that you will consider signing. This is just terrible, and you did mention that a lot of the children in the welfare system, in the apparatus, have experienced some dreadful things, and the last thing that they need that is going to be helpful is psychiatric drugs to, which just it mentally changes their their brain. It's like a chemical lobotomy in some instances. And I don't watch a lot of TV, but there's a program that I've seen a couple times called Killer Kids, and it talks about some of the children that have actually engaged in killing their parents and their grandparents and the lives that they have led that brought them to that moment when they did these horrible acts of violence. And when you see them growing up under these horrific circumstances, you can kind of say, gosh, a lot of terrible things happened to them as children. And yet the psychiatric industry is doing just as many criminal things, in my opinion, to these vulnerable, our upcoming generation. It just makes me absolutely sick.
Yes, and if you look at many of the life experiences, as you said, they're horrendous. But then if you also delve deeper, you can see that many of these children were on psychiatric drugs. And on the inserts of these drugs, it says clearly, can cause suicidal ideation, homicidal ideation, violent psychoses, hallucinations. It's unbelievable to me that I have lived to see this, that we're doing this to children.
Yes, and you're right. You brought up a good point. A lot of children have grown up with alcoholic parents, with in poverty and all kinds of situations, but they don't just turn around and kill their parents. But if they've taken psychiatric drugs, well, that's a different story.
We've always had abusive parents. Always. What we haven't always had is this unbelievable violence that we're seeing now, you know, going into a school and shooting up 5 and 6 year old babies. We haven't always had this. Right. So if it was a result of terrible parenting that we've had since the beginning of time immemorial, we would have been seeing this. We haven't been. We haven't been seeing suicides of 5, 6, 7 year old children ever in the history of recorded time. And now we're seeing 5 and 6 year olds killing themselves, and yes, documented on psychiatric drugs.
Right.
I think one of the things we really have to talk about, because I think it's probably at the root of this, is this chemical imbalance hypothesis that's been put out. And many people are just under the assumption that anxiety or depression or ADHD is a result of a chemical imbalance in the brain. They hear this on TV, they hear it from doctors, they hear it from their friends. But if you listen to those commercials really, really close, it says maybe the result of a chemical imbalance. The reason they have to add that caveat is because we have no scientific evidence supporting the chemical imbalance theory. And if your listeners want to test what I'm saying, all they have to do is call their physician and say, I'd like to have the serotonin or the dopamine or the norepinephrine in my brain checked on Monday. There's no way we can test the chemicals in your brain. We can upon autopsy, but we can't do a blood workup to say, oh, you're low on norepinephrine, oh, you're low on serotonin. But we bought this hook, line, and sinker, and that's why we're giving all these psychiatric drugs to correct the supposed imbalance. Now, here's my question as a scientist. If you can't measure something, how in God's name would you know if it's imbalanced?
And why would you be so presumptuous as to suggest taking a drug that you don't even know how it's going to react on that person, and that you don't know if it's going to be harmful, and it's unknown what it might do. I mean, it's as you say, lunacy.
It is lunacy. And it, for the first time in recorded human history, we're seeing drugs that the actual effects of the drug are worse than the initial complaint. I mean, what's worse? Feeling depressed and sad and lethargic, or killing yourself. I mean,
right.
It's incredible to me. But
right. This
is big business. This is big business. And in my opinion, that's the bottom line here.
Right. They've corporatized and medicalized society and emotions and characteristics. And the idea that we have direct-to-consumer advertising. And when I see these advertisements on TV, it tells you all the things that could happen to you. And the list goes on. And I have to laugh because they think, and you would risk all of those things just to feel happier? Oh my gosh, it is absolutely ridiculous.
Especially when we know there's so many other things that aren't dangerous for you that can make you, as you said, happier. For example, we all need 20 to 40 minutes of direct sunlight every day to get our recommended dose of vitamin D. And no, you can't get it in a pill form or from your cereal. You have to be out in the sun. The other thing we know is exercise, a healthy, good diet. And one of the hidden correlates that we don't want to talk about is helping others. If you're feeling really sad, you're crying all the time, you've lost interest in social activities, I have a suggestion for you, because I've done this in my own life when I was feeling all of those things. And that is, go to your local nursing home. Go to your local infant intensive care unit. And you will see very quickly there are many, many, many human beings in your very own community that have it much worse than you do. And something magic happens. When you start helping those folks, you forget about your own depression. It's so amazing how this works.
Indeed. I have experienced that also. It does get your mind off of your own problems, and it gives you added perception. And I think we've become such a self-centered society that we fail to see what we do have. We look at things as... The glass is half empty instead of half full. I so appreciate your sentiments and your wisdom and common sense. This is all common sense.
Go ahead. It all goes back to, if a physician prescribes you direct sunlight, walking for 30 minutes a day, being with the nursing home folks, being around healthy people, they're not going to make any money on that prescription. So they're biting the hand that feeds them. They have to have you believe that your brain is broken and that it needs psychiatric medications in order to function properly. Our brains really are broken. They really are broken. How did they get broken in less than one generation? Bioevolutionarily speaking, our brains couldn't have changed that dramatically in the course of 15 or 20 years. That would take hundreds of thousands of years to chemically alter a human brain. But we bought this hook, line, and sinker with no scientific validity backing it up.
Exactly. Oh, my goodness. We are at the top of the hour. We will be back at 6 minutes after the hour. Listeners, go sit in the sun for 6 minutes. But don't forget to come back, okay? Be back at 6 minutes after the hour. And this is Deanna. This is our second hour, and we will be taking questions from our listeners at 800-313-9443. Our guest, for the second hour also is Dr. Jeannie Stolzer, and that name is spelled S-T-O-L-Z-E-R. And please do visit CCHRINT.org and learn about parental rights and, well, a lot of other things. Now, there's a question that I'm sure that people that would like to have answered, and that is, well, let me give you an example. I was talking to a friend recently, and she was telling me about her mother-in-law, that her mother-in-law was just very, very cranky and irritable, and as soon as they put her on an SSRI, she was just so pleasant, and she got along with people, and so why is it that would occur? And why would people continue to take the psychiatric medications, particularly if they're so dangerous? But is it because, I'm asking several questions here, is it because they don't recognize that these side effects are actually due to the medication and they assume that it's due to their so-called brain disease?
Well, I think one of the important things to talk about, first off, is she said her mother-in-law. I said earlier that all developmental processes come with challenges, like menopause. You can be very crabby. You can have hormonal fluctuations. You can go from, you know, dark to light really, really fast. This is normative life. And yes, we have always had substances we can take to make us happy. Now, most people, if that mother-in-law was drinking gin to feel happy, we would say, wait a minute, you know, you could get addicted to this. This isn't a good thing. But when it's coming from a doctor, we don't think about the addictive properties. We don't think about how difficult these highly addictive substances will be to get off. We don't think about the brain atrophy that these substances are causing. And I mean that, brain atrophy. So it's so interesting to me. When did we decide as a culture that life was all about happiness and the good ship lollipop? No, there's ebbs and flows as there is in all of nature. And we have to find the tools to deal with those ebbs and flows because that's the nature of human existence, and it has been for millions of years.
Certainly, and this mother-in-law certainly wouldn't go to the corner and buy some drugs off of a street dealer. And yet,
I'll say this, and this may be way too radical for you, but it's just my opinion. At least if she was buying from the street dealer is not going to tell her she has a chemical imbalance in her brain, that her brain is flawed or broken. That dealer is going to say, here, take these, they'll make you feel better. She knows it's wrong. He knows it's wrong. Everybody knows it's wrong. She does it anyway. But with the stamp of approval from the pharmaceutical industry and the physicians, somehow we've made this process acceptable. And I don't understand it.
Indeed. Well, we do have a caller with some questions. Why don't we take Mitzi in Florida? Mitzi, welcome.
Hi. I really would like to make a couple of comments because I was really offended right away by blaming school people for, you know, labeling kids and for ADHD. It's been my experience that there's a growing number of students that come to school that have biological parents, but they don't have traditional parents in any way, shape, or fashion. Such parents even know that if they get the label of some kind of disability, they can get a check from the government. And I also, you know, that, you know, they want the money because they can get a disability check. But in Florida, if you have this IEP, you can even get a scholarship to go to another school. And schools really don't want kids to leave, and school people are very aware that kids on drugs will be maybe potentially violent. And because they're the ones dealing with the gun shootings, you know, and our society frowns on anything right and wrong. You know, there's a breakdown in the family. There's a high unemployment rate. Some of the parents are on drugs. They're incarcerated. The bad diets, the processed foods, Being responsible is out of date. Nobody thinks, it's all up to the school. It's been my experience that parents are seeking the medication. It's also been my experience that when a couple gets divorced and the kid's having trouble and he can't focus, the first thing they tell you in a parent meeting is, oh, we're putting him on drugs. And then a few weeks later, you're finding out this kid has some discipline issues that are about violence due to this the drugs that they've been taking. There was an amazing article in the New York Times last year about a college student whose kids are taking ADHD medicine because it helps them focus. This kid was perfectly fine all through high school, but on his own had sought it because it's an in-style thing to do, and he went back and killed his family. You know, it's the breakdown of the family. Nobody wants to talk about that. No politician would get elected for stating that. But the family is not intact. You know, we need to do it and ask your guest, and I'm very excited about that she's talking about this today. Does she think that these parents are on drugs? The current generation, they grew up on the ADHD medicine. They take the drugs. Their children, we have a growing number of kids that have fetal alcohol syndrome and meth babies. Is there a correlation between that and them putting our kids on drugs? It is a growing problem. And I really appreciate you talking about it, and I appreciate you taking my comments.
Okay. What do you think, Doctor?
I appreciate her bringing up the economic incentive that parents also have to collect Social Security checks for their children. If you can get your 10-month-old diagnosed with depression or ADHD, you have a Social Security check until that child's 18 years old. I do appreciate that, but it doesn't negate the fact, according to Bauman's research, that 98% of all referrals for psychiatric drugs are coming from the United States public school system. So I know that there's converging variables that are related to this topic. That is for sure. And she made a very interesting comment. I always chuckle inside when I hear this about meth babies. She was talking, I presume, about methamphetamine, which is an illegal substance, a psychostimulant. Methamphetamine is very, very similar to methylphenidate. Methylphenidate is the name of Ritalin. So again, we have this collective culture that we hate the meth. Unless it's methylphenidate, the Ritalin, that is okay. But the methamphetamine, oh God, no. But these are cousins. Neuropharmacologically, these are very similar drugs. So again, we base on if a drug is good or bad, if you're getting it from a dealer or from a physician. It's very interesting to me.
I don't think giving kids Ritalin or any medication is good at all. I don't. And I think it causes a lot of damage. I think everybody should look at what the drugs say, the side effects.
Oh, my God, yes. The important thing that you brought up was the economic linkages that we can see. Look how many people are making money. I mean, really, you talked about parents, talk about schools, physicians, mental health care workers. I mean, it's rampant. Everybody is profiting from this except the child. They're the ones that are being intrinsically hurt from this.
Can I like to say this, too? I don't think schools are really benefiting from the labels and kids going on medication because there's... there's actually been lawsuits in Florida from the superintendents for the underfunded mandates of exceptional student education. It's even difficult to get kids labeled.
All righty, ladies, we do have a 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Misty, if you have another question, you're welcome to stay over the break. We'll be right back. Deanna, our guest today is Dr. Jeannie Stolzer. We will take your calls at 800-313-9443. And please do visit cchrint.org and also visit the links on the schedule page so that you can read some of Dr. Stolzer's work. And Misty did not stay over, but she brought up a very interesting point. She mentioned fetal alcohol syndrome associated with some of the the challenges that infants might have?
Fetal alcohol syndrome would not be classified as a psychiatric disorder. Fetal alcohol syndrome is a neurological problem that resulted from toxins in the mother's bloodstream, i.e. alcohol. That is not a psychiatric disorder. It is a form of mental retardation. It is a physical disease. It is not a psychiatric disease.
Okay.
Those are two very, 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 very different things. We don't assess fetal alcohol syndrome by a checklist of behaviors. We can actually see atrophy in the brain of fetal alcohol syndrome children. Their brains, when they were developing, were inundated with toxins called alcohol. So I want to make it clear, maybe I gave the wrong impression. I know, I am aware that there are many, many, many excellent public school teachers who are incensed by this psychiatric paradigm we're immersed in. I know there are, and they're speaking loudly. The fact remains that schools profit economically from the labeling of children. It's a federal mandate.
Right, and it's perfectly obvious, or it wouldn't be happening. Correct? I mean, it is happening.
It's happening.
Yes.
It's happening. That doesn't negate that there are wonderful teachers in the public school system who are incensed by this convocade of psychiatric of children.
Absolutely. All righty, let's take another caller. Let's take Pam in Michigan. Pam, welcome to the program.
Hi, I'm so happy to hear this topic being discussed today. Doctor, you are my new hero. I am a former Head Start employee.
God love you.
Pardon me?
I said, God love you. Talk to us.
I absolutely love the program. However, there were some things about it that kind of disturbed me. Everything needed to be gender neutral and you know, things like that. And but I absolutely loved the program. I went and continued my education and got my basic early childhood degree. And I work at an elementary school now, and I apply a lot of the things that I learned along the way with the children I deal with today, and I absolutely love them. And the thing I want them to know is that you are cared about. I care about you. You made a mistake in judgment. Let's work through this. And I always have the children look at each other and work it out. And they do when they're given the opportunity and they're helped to be given, you know, words to help them explain their feelings. But what I see in this whole thing is that this is social engineering, and it really upsets me. And I just want to continue to listen to you. I just wanted to pipe in, and I have a grandchild in my house now, an infant, and my daughter is nursing him, and I want to nurture anyone who will take the time to parent their children. I will do whatever I can to help them and to nurture them into being the nurturing parents that they were, that God meant them to be. So anyway, I just wanted to pipe in and thank you so much for this topic. And Deanna, I miss you a lot. Thanks.
Yes, I miss Monday through Friday too, but we still have some really wonderful, wonderful guests on the weekend. So thank you for listening.
Thank you.
That call. Wonderful to hear.
Yeah. Indeed. Indeed. It's wonderful that people are using, the talents and the skills and the, I don't want to call them tactics, but strategies of good parenting that we are supposed to use instead of just giving a kid a pill. It's just, it is mind-boggling, to say the least. And
the tools that we know make healthy children, compassion, caring, empathy, talking with them, helping them to understand. We're all trying to grow. We're all learning from our mistakes.
We'll figure this out together.
Yes. And the profitability in this is just unbelievable. If you look at all of the number of children that are on, for instance, Paxil or Prozac or any of those SSRI drugs, you can sell a pill over and over and over and over, and when you consider all the people that are on these drugs, we're talking, as you said before, we're talking a $1 trillion industry here.
It is, and depression right now is the number one disability in American women aged 18 to 44. So it's not only children. We're drugging the hell out of women and other adult populations, particularly our elderly. So when you think about these drugs, and please have your listeners check this. Don't take my word for this. All psychiatric drugs, doesn't matter if it's an antidepressant, an ADHD drug, an antidepressant, are in the same classification. They're called Schedule II drugs. Schedule II drugs are in the same classification as heroin, morphine, cocaine, methamphetamines, and all the opioids. These are our most dangerous addictive drugs. They're Schedule II drugs. People don't want to look at that. So when you say, you know, my mother-in-law is doing so much better on her Schedule II drug, or my two-year-old nephew, at what cost? And I always do, when people say they're doing so much better, define better. What is better? Is better drug-induced docility and happy? Is that better?
Indeed. And it's a... The medics are prone to blame the patient. I had a friend that went in for a hip replacement, and they had this patient just drugged up to the point that that she was seeing things. She was hallucinating, and she mentioned it to the nurse, and the nurse said, "Oh, you're older, and it's because of your age that you're experiencing this. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the drugs."
No. No, we have to become informed consumers. We have to become self-advocates. We have to be informed of the research, and then we have to make informed decisions. I think when we look, ADHD, I want to talk about that for a second, because it is our number one diagnosis in infancy and early childhood, so it's typically boys that are getting diagnosed at really early ages. And in 1950 in America, ADHD didn't exist. In 1970, we had a disease called hyperactivity disorder. That's what it was called, hyperactivity disorder. 1970, about 2,000 kids were diagnosed, and the standard method of treatment was behavior modification. Fast forward to 2014, we have millions and millions of infants and children on these drugs, and it's mind-boggling. It's absolutely mind-boggling.
Indeed, and it's outrageous. It makes me very sad. It really does. All righty, we are going to a 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors, and we'll take some more calls at 800-313-9443. Be right back. Welcome back. It's Deanna, and we are taking questions at 800-313-9443 with our guest today, Dr. Jeannie Stolzer. And please do be sure and visit CCHRINT.org and look at the resources that are available there. Did you want to say anything about what Pam said before we go on to another caller?
I think we can take another caller.
All righty. Let's take Fred in Michigan. Fred, welcome.
Hi, Deanna.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you. Enjoying the sunshine. And one of the reasons I called when I heard the gal from Michigan call in, there's this fellow, John Ott, O-T-T. He's the inventor of what's called the Ott bulb or Ott light. And he was a friend of Walt Disney, and he did the time-lapse photography research on plant life cycles, and he discovered that the 6,500K wavelength was immensely, augmentative and stimulative of efficient optimum plant growth. And then he decided to explore what effect it would have in school rooms, where he would replace the toxic fluorescent tube bulb with his hot tube, and magically, over the course of, say, 6 to 8 weeks, the hyperactivity disorders cleared in the kid. And then that was Sarasota, Florida, and then he did an experiment out in California, school system there. Then he did the Dayton Police Department. They had equally impressive results relative to productivity and energy and all that. But I wanted to interject that because I was able to special order the 42-watt CFL bulb in 6,500K through the Home Depot, and they're just a totally awesome wavelength. I don't use any other bulb. So there's that, and then, of course, I tuned in late, so maybe you already discussed the role of all the toxic synthetic chemicals that are in the everyday food staples that people are consuming, especially children. I remember growing up, Captain Crunch, Count Chocula, all those wonderful, even Wheaties, and I forgot the other one. What's there's
Cheerios?
Cheerios, but there was a Wheaties. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, when you read the label, you see there's a thing called trisodium phosphate, TSP. Well, when I decided to do some engine work and I wanted to get the engine crud, grease and all that out of the way, I would use, of course, a concentrate of TSP. And then you want to get the old paint residue off aluminum siding, which I did one year, paint it, I would use a TSP. But there is in General Mills cereals, TSP. So seems like a covert program of poisoning the American populace. And I had friends who were planning a family, and I said, be sure you don't let the medical deities persuade you to have children shot up with pathogenic cocktails. And they said, well, we have to. It's the law. I said, well, I don't believe it is. So I contacted the state of Michigan Department of Public Health, and it took me about 2 weeks to finally get a functional person who, and I think she was a nurse, she said, no, it isn't the law. It is merely a recommendation. And if the parents don't want their kids vaccinated or on any of these, Ritalin, whatever, SSRIs, all they have to do is tell them no, and they have to back off, whether they say it's a philosophical situation with them, religious, whatever. But it's merely a recommendation, this woman said at the state of Michigan Department of Public Health, because the school districts get an endowment, get a financial reward for meeting a particular quota of vaccinated school kids. So, and then when I accompanied a buddy with PTSD to his psychologist and they were pushing SSRIs, I said, oh, why don't we look at the toxicity data sheet? And, that was like asking for, a round-trip ticket to the moon. I said, look, Doc, tell you what, let's just be really brief about this. Have you taken these drugs? Have you used them yourself? Because if they're good, therapeutically without side effects, then they must be good preventively, and you must be willing to sign a contract that should any side effect, undesirable effect occur, whether minor or major, like suicide or homicidal activity, you will take full responsibility. Well, that ended the meeting right there. And I told the guy, look, I told the guy, I happen to know already. And I quoted a few books done by Ayurvedic docs. The most recent one, Healing Spices, by a guy out there, MD Anderson, Healing Spices. So I said, hey, we're just going to do it the natural way, because I already know at least 50% of the pharmaceutical petrochemicals are synthetic derivatives of naturally occurring medicinal plant extracts.
Wow. So, Dr. Stolzer, what are your views on this?
I think he's bringing up some really excellent points. I really do. And I appreciate new inventions, wavelengths, but I think he should check out Dr. Wilson, E.O. Wilson, out of Harvard, his biophilia hypothesis. Dr. Wilson, in that biophilia hypothesis, is talking about how we're stripping human beings of natural sunlight, of contact with the earth, about genetically modified foods, herbicides, pesticides, blah, 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 hormones, antibiotics, and how this is all converging. And so I think he's bringing up some really good points, but I would have a different opinion about, instead of kids needing artificial light, I believe they need to be outside in natural sunlight, running, jumping, and climbing. And I especially loved his, because I've actually published data on this, about having physicians sign contracts. If this drug will not hurt my developing fetus, or this drug will not hurt my three-year-old, or this drug will not hurt me, here's a contract to sign that it will not cause any ill side effects, including suicide, homicide, blah, 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 and have them sign it. And you will see them run like a dog with their tail between their legs because they won't sign it. And that's how you know the drugs they're advertising and prescribing are not safe for us or our developing babies or our children.
Indeed. Well, thank you so much, Fred. I appreciate your phone call.
One more thing, if I may. Can I... Doctor, are you familiar with Abram Hoffer, MD, PhD?
I'm not.
Abram Hoffer was one of the pioneers in this realm. I can't recall the titles of his books, but he literally proved clinically over and over and over again that schizophrenia, for instance, is totally reversible, corrected, transformed with nutrition.
Absolutely, and I've got it right here. I'm going to make sure so I don't give you the wrong information. The World Health Organization has published research. It's Mosher and Burti, that's B-U-R-T-I. There's one more here. Gottsner and Haslam also published research with schizophrenia that empathetic, non-coercive, relational, interventional therapy, including family therapy, was significantly more successful than drug therapy and or hospitalizations, even with schizophrenia. We have the data, but we don't have an educated populace that knows the data. We continue to prescribe these dangerous, mind-altering chemicals, and that's the path we're on because that's where the money is. And if we really want to heal, then we'll be looking at the data and see how to heal, how to cure, rather than to apply Band-Aid solutions such as psychiatric drugs, which cause a whole plethora of other problems.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Fred, for your phone call. Always appreciate hearing from you, and you always have something to contribute that's very worthwhile. So thank you so much. All righty. Other people who have questions, just call 800-313-9443. We are going to a break in a few seconds, and we talked about this earlier today, about the necessity, the absolute necessity of educating the public about these horrible drugs so that they can make more informed decisions. And I think that that's a big problem. People do not read the inserts on those packages. They just don't read. And so let's talk about that on the other side of the break. We'll be back in 3 minutes after a word from our sponsors. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Dr. Jeannie Stolzer. We will take your phone calls at 800-313-9443, and we do have another caller. You mentioned, you kind of implied the earthing which is a good thing, that we should be in touch with the earth. And I believe that kids should be outside running and playing and not inside watching TV or playing video games. I think that that really has a lot to do with the culture and the way that children are really being they're just being deprived of something that they ought to naturally be doing.
Well, their basic bioevolutionary heritage, or sitting in a school desk for 9 hours a day. When you look at other countries on the planet, their school days are 3 or 4 hours a day.
Ah, and even if you're homeschooling, you're really not you're not tied to a desk for 8 hours a day. You are.
During the break, I was looking through the DSM, and I found an interesting quote. Behind each disease, whether it's anxiety, depression, ADHD, it says, there is no neurological, cognitive, metabolic, or any other test that can definitively confirm the existence of this mental disorder. That's pretty startling. We can't test for it. Do you have it? And I was also looking through inserts here, drug inserts, and according to the pharmaceutical inserts, long-term effects in infants, children, and adolescents are unknown. How they work is unknown. The mode of therapeutic action, unknown. Safety of long-term use, i.e. more than 2 weeks, unknown. This is in the drug insert.
Wow. And hardly anyone reads those. I mean, they're 7-point font, and they're printed on awful paper, and people simply don't read them. I don't even think physicians read those things.
I know, but I have some right here. Do you want me to go through a couple of them?
Sure, and then we'll take Kathy in Indiana.
Okay, go ahead. Insomnia, seizures, agitation, irritability, nervousness, confusion, visual disturbances, hallucination, aggression, disorientation, personality changes, suicidal ideation, homicidal ideation, psychosis, mania, paranoia. Okay, let's go to the antidepressants. A loss of interest in social activities, sadness, crying, sleep disturbances, lack of energy, mania, psychosis, violence, loss of impulse control, flat affect, loss of empathy. Loss of empathy, delirium, brain abnormalities, suicidal ideation, homicidal ideation. I mean, it just goes on, and it's unbelievable.
It is.
Okay, let's take that caller.
Or you could just be sad.
Yeah.
So which would be best, all of those things you just said, or to be sad for a while?
Well, you know what? When you really say that, it makes so much sense. Look at nature, the trees. Just 2 months ago, they were completely bare. They looked dead. But they're not anymore. That is what nature does. It ebbs and it flows and it comes back.
Mm-hmm.
But it does.
Yep. That's how people work, too.
Exactly. We are part of nature, and we forget that. We really forget that.
Wow. All right, Kathy. Welcome.
Hi, ladies. Thanks for taking my call. This is one of my favorite subjects. I've been talking about it for decades now. And the earthing, drugging our children to death, it's just crazy. They tried to drug my grandson when I was in Florida. They called us in for the roundtable meeting, but I had read up on it. I knew what they were up to. When they shoved the test over there, I asked the lady, is that the Connors test? She said, yeah. I said, we don't do drugs. She said, well, my son has ADHD. I said, good, he can have our share then. And she wasn't real pleased with that. And I asked them, I said, how much do you get for each child that y'all label? And all seven of them in unison said nothing, which is a big fat lie. They get a stipend for each child that has special needs. And the lady at the copy machine cracked up about that. But and you know what their next suggestion was? Let's give him a pack-up buddy. Why didn't we think of that before we thought of drugging him, drugging his mind, you know? Let's give him a pack-up buddy to remind him to take his homework home. But then we weren't real popular after that. I'm so pleased people are finally chatting about it, though, because we are the most drug, least healthy population anywhere on the planet.
That's a fact.
That is the truth. And when I tell people that, they look at me like I'm quite crazy. Oh, but modern medicine is making us live longer. Well, no. I saw picture of some slaves that were like 115 and they were still walking on their own power. We're not living longer because of modern medicine. It's all the natural stuff has been declared unnatural. Breastfeeding, you know? That's looked down upon in public. And God made the breast for the babies, not the fellas, you know.
Right.
Everything natural has been turned upside down.
So you're right.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Kathy, for your phone call. Doctor, what are your views on that?
My views are, I want to say this very, very, very clearly. Before they can assess your child for anything, a learning disability, a psychiatric illness, anything, they must get written parental consent. So when you go, I loved how she said the round table meeting, because really that's what it is. You think you're going to meet Mrs. Smith. I mean, that's who called you. And you get, there's 8 or 10 people there. The school psychologist, principal, blah, 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 the counselor, and you're intimidated.
Of course.
What they're going to say typically is, you know, Johnny's not doing so good. He's not paying attention. He's off task, and we'd like to assess him. You have to sign that paper before any assessment can occur. So don't sign that paper. Now, you don't want to ignore if Johnny's having a problem, that's for sure. But a better way to deal with it, rather than having them assess them and, you know, the psychiatric drugs will follow, is you make up a plan. Make a new meeting for 2 weeks or a week. You make up a plan at home, i.e. get rid of TV, get rid of the computer, lots more physical activity, blah, 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 blah. And make the teacher implement a plan. We've got to improve, you know, Johnny's test scores and his behavior. So you make a plan. We're the adults here. And it's not going to come through psychiatric drugs. That's not the plan.
Right.
The plan is to help Johnny. But they cannot assess a child for any reason without written parental consent.
And usually those school assessments do lead to psychiatric drugs, correct?
Yes, and we do have some data to support that schools are actually giving out particular doctors' names or cards. See Dr. Blah Blah. What? If your child had tuberculosis, you would be recommending a doctor? Are you kidding me?
Right. Doctors get kickbacks from the drug companies.
Absolutely they do. Let us not ever forget that teachers are not now, nor have they ever been, trained as psychologists, psychiatrists, neurologists, developmentalists. They are trained in curriculum and instruction, not in complex psychiatric disorders.
Indeed. Oh, my goodness. Although they are trying to implement training for teachers just in the last year as part of the curriculum in some states, such as in Connecticut.
And it will pass. It will pass.
Yeah.
Because schools have become brokers for the pharmaceutical industry. And if that's too rash to say, I'm sorry, but that is exactly what's happening. We send our children to public schools to learn to read, write, do mathematics. We don't send our children to school to be assessed for mental illness. That's a parental prerogative. It's not the state.
You are just so terrific. I can't I cannot express how grateful I am for your wisdom and your knowledge that you've shared here with us today. The 2 hours have just gone by so rapidly. I hope that we can do this again. You are a breath of fresh air, and I know that my listeners are so appreciative. This is a topic that absolutely needs the wisdom that you have shared with us today, and I thank you so, so very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I hope that people will visit cchrint.org and see the resources there, and please, please do download those articles and look at what Dr. Stolzer has written. Thank you so very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we're at the top of the hour. We will be right back at 6 minutes after the hour. So stay with us, and we'll be talking to Bruce Wiseman. Yeah, this is Deanna, And this is our third hour, and we will continue to take phone calls at 800-313-9443. Our second guest today is supposed to be Bruce Wiseman, and we are attempting to contact him. And keep in mind that I did have another guest scheduled, and unfortunately that gentleman ended up in the hospital, which occurred, I believe, late Friday or yesterday, and so it was just wonderful that we could get Dr. Jeannie Stolzer on. It was just so nice of her to be on the program, and I didn't know that she would be on it until 10:30 last night. And what a wonderful guest she was. Anyway, we are continuing to attempt to get Bruce Wiseman on. He was on last week, and when he at the end of the program, I said, let's do this again sometime. And I don't think that we recognized that it would be just a week later. Anyway, hopefully we can continue trying to contact him. Meanwhile, I want to just kind of go over some facts that are very relevant to our topic today. And please do feel free to call in and contribute. And again, the number is 800-313-9443. Fact number one, an astounding 70 million Americans are taking legal mind-altering drugs right now. When you consider the number of the total population, I think it's, what, 330 million? 70 million Americans are taking legal mind-altering drugs. That is absolutely unbelievable. Number two fact. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, doctors wrote more than 250 million prescriptions for antidepressants during 2010. Now, if you go into your regular general practitioner and you say something like, "Oh, my mother just passed away a couple weeks ago," the first thing that he or she might say is, "Would you like something for your depression?" Because most of the prescriptions now are written by your general practitioner. And they are encouraged to do this because a doctor in the continuing educational apparatus that they're all involved in go to conferences where they have psychiatrists and drug representatives and people like that promoting the latest in drug therapy. And so the general practitioners who didn't used to write prescriptions for antidepressants are now writing prescriptions for those antidepressants. So you don't even have to go to a psychiatrist to get them. Number three, according to a study conducted by the Mayo Clinic, nearly 70% of all Americans are on at least one prescription drug. An astounding 20% of all Americans are on at least five prescription drugs. And I think that this is particularly applicable to older people. Sometimes I'll be talking with friends or older relatives or whatnot, and they will say, "Oh, yes, my mother-in-law is on 10 different prescriptions." And you think, "My gosh, that's insane." Now, my grandmother, my grandparents, were probably not on anything. I don't recall any of them having a medicine cabinet full of prescription drugs. And yet, I believe that when Medicare came into being, particularly Schedule D, which I think that was, I don't know what date that was. But I think that the drug companies view this as an opportunity to make a lot of money. That if people can get free drugs that somehow they will suddenly develop the sicknesses, the maladies, the medical necessity to be taking those drugs, which seems a shame. And I think that this also happens in nursing homes, where you go into a nursing home and a lot of people are on cholesterol lowering drugs, which are particularly dangerous. A lot of people think that they have to have lower cholesterol when in fact you really need about all the cholesterol that you can get, because it helps you to think. And they change the standard for what your cholesterol should be, in order to sell more cholesterol-lowering drugs. Well, anyway, these drugs make you contribute to irritability. And so when people are in the nursing home, and I think most of the people are on cholesterol-lowering drugs in the nursing home, if they become irritable, then, of course, the next step is to put them on an SSRI drug. And of course, it's all profits for the drug companies. Fact number four. Americans spent more than $280 billion on prescription drugs during 2013. Wow. I mean, that's a lot of money. And our guest said, in the second hour, or maybe it was one of the callers said, that we supposedly have the very, very best health in all the world, that our country is known for having great health, when in fact we take probably more drugs than any other country, and we also probably take 98% of all the Ritalin that's sold in the world is sold to people in this country. And remember that is a Schedule II drug, which is like cocaine or heroin. That's Schedule II, and it is incredibly addictive. Okay, fact number five. According to the CDC, approximately 9 out of every 10 Americans that are at least 60 years old say that they have taken at least one prescription drug within the last month. So I think that I don't have anything to say about that. There are 60 million Americans that abuse alcohol. But at least I think alcohol, as was indicated in the last hour, at least you know about the dangers of alcohol. Because, I mean, it's alcoholism is a fact that, you know, a lot of people have been around people who have been alcoholic, and at least you know the dangers. But when a doctor recommends a drug that is far, far more dangerous, there's a tendency to believe the doctor. And when you look back, I did a little study this past week on all of the doctor programs that were available on television during the 60s, which is when the drug culture, I'm talking about the legal drug culture, was developing. And I was just amazed at all of the programs that were oriented towards the doctor is a God kind of a person, knows everything, never gets sick, is all-knowing, and knows exactly what to prescribe for all of these patients that he sees in these television programs. All right, we're going for a three-minute break. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Deanna, and we have an answer. Medicare Part D took effect January 1st, 2006, and that came from somebody in our chat room. Our chat room is just full of really wonderful, informed people. So thank you so much for providing that answer for us. let me go back to these facts, and then we'll take some phone calls. 19 facts. Okay. Number seven. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, 22 million Americans use illegal drugs. Okay. There are more people who use the so-called legal drugs than there are people who use illegal drugs, and you're more apt to have severe adverse reactions from legal drugs than you are from illegal drugs. Number eight, incredibly, more than 11% of all Americans that are 12 years of age or older admit that they have driven home under the influence of alcohol at least once during the past year. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, there is an unintentional drug overdose death in the United States every 19 minutes. Every 19 minutes. And I believe I've mentioned on the program before that at least 106,000 people, and this was according to Dr. Jennifer Daniels, at least 106,000 people die within the hospital each and every year due to unintentional drug overdose. Okay? That is according to the records for the CDC. So the hospital is not a place that you really want to be, because they will, they're the ones that are passing out the drugs. So you have to ask yourself, well, if that's the case, and there's so many drug overdoses in the hospital, well, that's it's kind of a deadly place to be. Number 10. In the United States today, prescription painkillers kill more Americans than heroin and cocaine combined. Number 11, according to the CDC, approximately three quarters of a million people a year are rushed to emergency rooms in the United States because of adverse reactions to pharmaceutical drugs. Now, this is also applicable to over-the-counter drugs, drugs that you don't need a prescription for. And this has happened to me. I have had anaphylactic shock a couple of times. Not a good thing. Number 12. According to Alternet, 11 of the 12 new-to-market drugs approved by the Food and Drug Administration were priced above $100,000 per patient per year in 2012. Now, if you note the drug advertisements on TV, a lot of them talk about new drugs that have just been developed, just been approved. I don't think it's wise to take any drugs at all. But to take a drug that has only just been newly approved, you are the guinea pig. You are part of the clinical experiment, part of the clinical trial. In fact, I think that probably everyone on a drug in America today are part of the clinical trial, because most of the drug trials last 6 or 7 weeks. They are all stacked. And so the drug companies really don't recognize what the drug does to anybody until it goes on the market. Number 13, the percentage of women taking antidepressants in America is higher than in any other country in the world. Number 14, many of these antidepressants contain warnings that suicidal thoughts are one of the side effects that should be expected. They should be expected. The suicide rate for Americans between the ages of 35 and 64 rose by close to 30% between 1999 and 2010. The number of Americans that are killed by suicide via suicide now exceeds the number of Americans that die as a result of car accidents each and every year. Okay. Number 15, in 2010, the average teen in the United States was taking 1.2 central nervous system drugs. Those are the kind of drugs which treat conditions such as ADHD and depression. Number 16, children in the United States are 3 times more likely to be prescribed antidepressants as children in Europe are. Now, in Europe, in 2003, or at least in England, they outlawed SSRIs for children under the age of 18. And as a consequence of that, in 2004, the FDA decided, oh, well, maybe we better reevaluate whether we should outlaw these drugs. But instead, they simply put black box warnings on these drugs. In other words, they said, well, this might cause suicide or homicide or violence, some of those same symptoms, some of those same reactions, adverse reactions that Dr. Stolzer mentioned in the second hour. Number 17. A shocking government accountability office report discovered that approximately 1/3 of all foster children in the United States are on at least one psychiatric drug. And I think it's probably greater than 1/3. I think it's closer to probably 90%, because the children in the foster care program get Medicaid. And Medicaid is probably one of the government programs that is most abused. And of course, the pharmaceutical company is going to get as much bang out of the Medicaid program as they possibly can. Number 18, a survey conducted by the National Institute on Drug Abuse found that more than 15% of all U.S. high school seniors abuse prescription drugs. Number 19. And I've heard of people, of teenagers getting into their parents' cabinet and just taking these drugs without any reason, simply to get a high or to, I don't know. Why would anybody take a drug that that is so harmful, because they don't know it's permanently it can permanently damage a person. Number 19, it turns out that dealing drugs is extremely profitable. The 11 largest pharmaceutical companies combined manage to rake in approximately $85 billion. In profits in 2012, I had to count the zeros, $85 billion just in profits in 2012. Oh, my goodness. In America today, doctors are trained that there are just two potential solutions to any problem. Either you prescribe a pill or you cut someone open. Surgery and drugs are pretty much the only alternatives that they can offer. And of course, if you're talking about chemotherapy, then you can add one more, burn, poison, or drugs. All right. We'll be right back. And when we come back, we'll take some calls. Back in 3 minutes. Deanna, and just for your information, I will be subbing for Clint Richardson on Monday and Tuesday evening, and that program is 7 to 9, and that is Central Time, so I look forward to having you join me then. Another thing is that my third book in the trilogy is finally out. It is available at Amazon. It is called The Ruling Elite, Death, Destruction, and Domination. I don't have copies yet for sale, but it is available on Amazon. All right, let's take a caller. Let's take Chris in Las Vegas. Chris, welcome.
Oh, well, good afternoon, Deanna.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I am wonderful. I really want to thank you for that superlatively informative and educational first 2 hours. with Dr. Stolzer.
Isn't she just wonderful?
Oh, and the listeners really have got to visit her website. I think it's the ICC.
CCHR, CCHRINT.
Absolutely. When you get to that site, be sure to look on her her little left tab there. They've got about psych crimes, which is psychiatric crime database. She's also got one on there on the side effects of common psychiatric drugs. It's about a 40-page treatise. These are just tremendously informative, and anybody that is fighting against these diabolical, deceitful schemes of the psychoactive industry, the psychiatric or psychologists, that are just really these demented witch doctors who claim that they have some insight into the human psychic or chemical imbalances that they can magically detect from looking or listening for a few minutes, and then recommend these drugs that forever alter their bodies and their chemistry and their psychobalances and their brains, and perhaps render them in need of further treatment perpetually for their whole life.
I think that it is a lifelong commitment because they are so addictive. Think about giving a 12-month-old baby heroin. Would any mother in their right mind do such a dastardly thing? Of course not. But she will readily accept a prescription for Prozac for her 12-month-old child from a doctor, just because that doctor has a white coat on and because she feels like he or she knows exactly what he's talking about. And the other thing is that people believe that the FDA has approved of these drugs, and of course they have, but they don't do any testing. The drug companies themselves do all the testing, and then they approach the FDA, and they present the results of their stacked drug trials, and get approval. And it's just amazing.
We have a really current, just a couple of weeks old experience with a brand new newborn, where we refused the injections. It turned out it went to be cesarean, but it seems that there's some really diabolical treachery going on with the birthing process, where they early apply these epidurals, and it seems to stall or delay or impede the dilation process that occurs naturally to aid in the natural delivery to enhance the likelihood of a cesarean surgical delivery, which is a lot more profitable for the hospital. But then the really insidious aspect is they always want to inject these brand new newborns, you know, usually 6 to 8 pounds, generally speaking, with these injections of who knows what, with thimerosal adjuvants, perhaps nano-engineered, derived from who knows what kind of animals, pigs or monkeys or other types of virus, even human viruses, to purportedly inoculate them for school, which they don't start till 5 or 6 years down the road. Why would you inject a newborn?
Exactly.
It's insane.
And why would you give a newborn hepatitis B, which is typically associated with sharing of needles between drug addicts? Or sexually transmitted diseases. Why would you give a newborn child, especially if the mother has shown no indication that she has hepatitis B?
Any lifestyle like that at all. You're absolutely right, Deanna, and this is really important because people must know their rights or they have no rights. And if you're not assertive of your rights and protecting your children from these murderous monsters in white lab coats that these, not all of them are, there's some good people in there, don't get me wrong, but so many of them are programmed and indoctrinated with this pseudoscience illusions that they look to profit for the doctors, the hospitals, and the medical community. And you know, and you talked about this a little bit in the first hour, that if there's some reason to declare a child or an adult special needs, they get double the money from the Social Security funds provided from Title IV that's administrated through the Department of Health and Human Services through the state's programs, through DCFS, Child and Family Services, Child Protective Services, and other state agencies that profit by the administration of these programs.
It kind of makes you assume that government officialdom is in bed with the corporations, right?
I think it's government is a corporation,
yes,
and so it partners with other corporations specifically. Although they give the illusion of being in the public's interest, they are definitely not. They're in their own private interest.
Yes. And we know from Clint's work about the corporation nation, and that the federal government is the key corporation, and that they invest heavily into the drug industry. In fact, when there was the first bird flu epidemic, supposedly the first bird flu epidemic, well, it was George W. Bush who wanted Congress to approve of this this vaccine for that epidemic that was supposed to happen to us, and it just happened that it was the vaccine was developed by the exact same company that Rumsfeld was previously the CEO of, and that he was heavily invested. And what do you know? He made millions.
I think George Bush had a high position. I think it was Merck.
Well, George H.W. Bush sat on the board of Eli Lilly. And so the Bushes, they go back quite a ways. Well, actually, when you look at the opium wars in China, I think they start their progress back that far.
You are such a diligent researcher on this. I would never question what you've discovered because you do your homework, Deanna, and we greatly respect you for doing so.
Oh, well, thank you. How kind of you.
Well, it's accurate. I got no agenda here. I'm not trying to promote you. It's just that you're a great researcher and you write good books that have fact-checked items in there so they are irrefutable if a person has the diligence and the intelligence to acquire them and read them.
You know, one of the books that I've been reading lately, I mean, it's not something you sit down and read, but I did have a 2003 copy of the Physician's Desk Reference. And it was kind of cumbersome. I gave it to a friend, and I replaced it with the Kindle copy, the latest edition. I believe it's from 2013. It's the 10th edition of the Physician's Desk Reference. And so, because it's on Kindle, it's very easy to search. And in going through some of the medications in there, I think and this is the consumer edition, and I would suspect that the physician's edition has even more information. But just going through the consumer edition, I haven't found a drug in there that I would be comfortable taking simply by looking at the adverse reactions. And I remember that Dr. Daniel said, there are no side effects. Those are the effects of the drug. And she also talked about the lethal dose. The lethal dose is the dose that 50% of a target population would die at that dose. And when you think of that and you recognize that these drug companies create these chemicals that do not help anybody, and that they recognize that there's a certain percentage of the population that are going to die if they take that drug, I think that it's something that we really need to look at, and that we need to start educating ourselves and not presume to believe what others are telling us, even if they seem to have a consensus. We need to research because it's our body.
Uh-oh, I hear the music.
Yes. Okay, stay on with me, and we'll be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Chris, are you still there? Is Chris still there?
Oh, yes, I am. I apologize. I muted out for the break and didn't get back on. I apologize. Don't hate me.
One of the things that I was going to talk to Bruce Wiseman about, and we talked about this, well, we talked about the suicide rate among the military last Sunday in the last hour, and one of the things that has kind of happened this week, although it emerged before this week, but I noticed it this week, is all this talk in the media about the situation at the VA, where people have had to wait in line to get care, and some people have perished. And I'm thinking, while I'm listening to this in the mainstream media, why haven't they mentioned the 8,000 people, veterans, and some people who have not even deployed, have not even seen active duty, that are killing themselves for, I mean, why no mention of them? Why are they concentrating on a few people? Well, it's probably not a few, but why aren't they talking about the suicides?
Well, you know, Deanna, you bring a very important question up. And the administration of these suicidal psychotropic drugs to our fighting men overseas, whether it's in response to actual stress from the environment and the actual conditions that they're exposed to and the deception they've been led to believe, of course, believe has a lie in the middle of it, so it's based upon what we're told by others rather than what we've learned for ourselves, is really traumatic to them. And, you know, whether they've got traumatic brain injuries or they've been exposed to seeing their friends or soldiers working and dying, being blown apart by roadside devices or inside their Humvees or whatever assault vehicles, whether they've been by Benghazi and seen their brothers in arms die beside them without being able to go to their aid, these can be very traumatic and stressful on your psyche, there's no doubt. But to pass out these chemicals with these known insidious side effects that are known to produce hallucinations, psychosis, neurosis, homicide, suicide, fratricide, many different things, and even some of them emulate the symptoms of sudden infant death syndrome, where they actually die in their sleep. And, of course, they claim they were suicided. It's just so insidious, insane, and diabolical. You have to examine what the motivation is for passing these things out like they're a food supplement or candy.
Right. Well, Stan White was on the program last week, and he did have a 23-year-old son that did die in his sleep. And that young man had been on 19 different psychiatric drugs. Now he had been to in warfare three times. He'd been on he'd been deployed three times. But many of the people who are taking the psychiatric drugs are either veterans. In other words, they're just veterans. They're not in the service anymore, or service people who have never been deployed, have never seen active duty. They may have a desk job here in the States. But I think the reason that they, and of course I think military life is very stressful to begin with. It's not a natural environment that you're living in. So I think that you can experience stress. But there's also the idea that they screen all of these people. The military screening, just which works something like the screening in the high schools. In other words, they screen you. They screen military people. I believe they screen them at least five different times. And what the screening does is just provide a conduit for customers for the pharmaceutical industry. Because when you take the screening test, there's hardly any way that you're going to come out of this test not having something for which they can drug you with for. Go ahead.
I was going to say, if the psychiatrist and psychologist or other treatment care workers, either in the indoctrination or in the induction facilities or in the treatment areas, are taught out of this DSM-5 that you and Dr. Solster talked about the first hour, the language in that has been obviously written by those in the legal community, or at least in association with them, because it is so divisively vague, ambiguous, and broad in its definition that basically whether you breathe, blink, or think, you can be accused of having some psychological diagnoses that they can treat and give you these drugs for to perpetuate. Of course, the symptoms of the drugs are a lot more problematic than the headaches or the troubled thoughts that you had before you went in.
Sure, sure. And they've proven, I mean, one person could go to 10 different psychiatrists and get 10 different diagnoses. And lately, I've been reading a lot of books by Dr. Bregan. And in one of the books, it's called Medication Madness. And this is, it's called Medication Madness, A Psychiatrist Exposes the Dangers of Mood-Altering Medications. And he has something which he calls, medication spellbinding. And it's just amazing how he describes this. And he says, many people who take the drugs become desperately depressed and suicidal, violently aggressive, or wildly out of control without realizing that their medication is causing them to think, to feel, and to act in unusual and otherwise abhorrent ways. And so you may just feel a little bit sad, and then you go and you're either screened because you're a teenager or screened because you're in the military, and you might just answer the questions to the point where they say, oh, well, you seem to be very depressed, so this is what we recommend. We recommend that you see Dr. So-and-so. And then this doctor puts you on a mind-altering drug, and your slight depression because of something that maybe occurred in your life or didn't occur in your life, because we have ups and downs. Sometimes I'm very, very happy, and other days I'm more somber because of circumstances. But these screening tests are just awful, because you are going to get diagnosed no matter what you say, or the questions are designed to guide you to a diagnosis so that you can be treated. It's really insidious.
You recall our Summers of Love in the 60s, whenever basically they had a pill to cure you're ill. They could give you uppers if you were down, or downers if you were up, or if you didn't like your condition, they could change your condition to whatever you wanted it to be through the hallucinogenics, or the special smoking stuffs, or the mushrooms, or whatever else they wanted to give you to elevate your condition to where you felt like you needed to be.
Exactly. And it's very interesting that Eli Lilly was the first producer of LSD in this country.
Sandoz Labs.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
You know, interesting enough, on your point on the illusion of these diseases, when we look into the law behind the qualification of an expert witness, and I may have spoken to you about this before, but I think it's worth repeating. When we look at the Daubert, D-A-U-B-E-R-T analysis, that is a test for the qualification of an expert witness and whether or not they have the standing that's proved by a three-pronged test to be proven as a qualified expert with verifiable results and outcomes that can be predicted with any degree of repetitivity.
Right.
And so under Daubert, there's another case called Kumho Tire, K-U-M-H-O, Tire Company versus Carmichael, that says effectually that the alleged science of psychiatry and psychology is only amounts to pseudoscience because it doesn't have any verifiable, repeatable outcomes of which can be treated with any degree of specificity, and therefore it's a subjective and interpretive, and each one
Absolutely.
Of these psychologists will give you a different diagnosis. So it's
of
hearsay.
Course. Of course. Ah, it is really a scam. A big, big, big scam. Well, thank you so much, Chris, and thank you, listeners, for joining me today. And hopefully that you will join me tomorrow night when I sub for Clint. So we'll talk with you then, and if not then, next week. Bye-bye. Have a wonderful, wonderful week. Bye-bye.